everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back this month, and this month we are reaching out to the farthest limitations of our known universe with two really epic sci-fi horror films.
They are really epic. They are like the cream of sci-fi horror, I dare say, with the exception of maybe Alien, which we've already covered. But these movies attack the sci-fi horror mashup genre in a very specific way. And there's similarities and there's differences, but I think they're a great pairing to watch together and talk about together.
And I think they're an interesting thing to do a couple months after we tackled John Carpenter's The Thing, which is, of course, one of the big horror films from the 1980s. And then going ahead to the first film we're going to talk about, Event Horizon, which is in 1997. And then the next film we're going to talk about, Sunshine, which is in 2007. So we're kind of leaping over the decades with science fiction horror and what it has to offer. And I think that's really cool, especially where The Thing was so situated on Earth and embroiled in men's dilemma. And now we're going into this kind of larger dilemma of humanity mm-hmm. and what it means to be human and what it doesn't mean to be human.
Yeah. So I feel like to get into this discussion, a conversation about these terms and these genres is in order. I think it's actually kind of a hot button topic right now. I'm seeing a lot of stuff on social media about what is and what isn't horror. And it seems to me that horror is doing very well right now. And what always tends to come along with that is as soon as a movie does really well in the genre, there's discussion about whether or not it's even horror. And it's a ridiculous debate as far as I'm concerned. I find these lines between genres really arbitrary for the most part. But when it comes to science fiction and horror and fantasy, the lines aren't all that arbitrary. And the more I dug into it, I actually found it kind of interesting. So science fiction is defined as being based on an environment that is similar to ours, understandable by us, but with significant technological or environmental elements that are different. And it needn't always be set in the future. It needn't always be set in space or even a high-tech world. Science fiction can be dystopian or post-apocalyptic, but it often involves space or time travel, as these are great unknowns. But what's really important to science fiction is it has to be sort of plausible. And a great example of that is Frankenstein. You know, bringing a body to life with electricity has never been done as far as we know, but we know what electricity is. We know what life and death are. We know that electricity is happening in the body in some capacity. So it's a scientific stretch that we can kind of get behind. Now, sci-fi needs to be internally coherent while having some continuity with the real world, as I was just saying. Fantasy isn't restrained by that. It only needs to be internally coherent, and it can be as implausible as it wants to be, as long as it makes sense within its own universe. And then horror is situated in the plausible before something disrupts that order from within, driving the terror. So it can be either the technology that fails us or human beings faltering amidst all this technology, which I'm sure we're going to get into. Horror and sci-fi are a favorite mashup of mine because I really like the thoughtfulness of speculative fiction. And it really, I feel like it chases the shadows that science tries to illuminate. And both of these films suggest that even if we were to conquer space and time, there's so much darkness beyond that still needs to be reckoned with. Now, I don't know if we've ever talked about Star Trek between the two of us, have we?
I don't think so.
Do you watch it?
I probably watched Next Generation a bit when I was a kid.
I watched Next Generation a ton when I was a kid. It was on at 6:30 p.m. every single weeknight. And it so happened that the first episode that I gave a chance, and Trekkies listening are going to love this, it's the episode where Tasha Yar dies. And when she dies, she was a pretty major character. So it was like felt within the show. And she has this elaborate funeral scene where she has recorded a hologram of herself saying goodbye to everybody. And so she goes through the crew one by one and kind of introduces them. It was introducing them to me very much as a first-time viewer. And I was like, oh, okay, here we go. And I was obsessed. And I kind of dropped off at Deep Space Nine because it was a very political drama that I couldn't really get into. But it's all on Netflix right now. So I've recently revisited it. And I plowed through Deep Space Nine. And I'm in the middle of Voyager right now. And I just love science fiction narratives. I love how speculative they are. And I've actually done some research on the sociology of science fiction and how sociology is kind of informed by science fiction narratives, as it forces us to think of things that we're not dealing with right now because we couldn't, but they're bridges that we'd necessarily have to cross should this technology come to pass.
That's interesting, because I did a bit of research for this episode looking into nihilism in science fiction, because between The Thing that we just recently talked about and these two films, there's so much nihilism in them.
Super nihilism.
Yeah. And it's dark and it's unrepenting and it feels really suffocating at some points, which I kind of like. Like, I like things that are that boldly dark. So I was reading this article, and it was in the Smithsonian Magazine, so we can link this in the show notes. And it was talking about the kind of nihilistic downturn of science fiction and how at its best it's something like Star Trek, which is about exploring new worlds, making allegiances, learning things, bettering ourselves through the notion of exploration and discovery. But how we lost the will to inspire a next generation, so to speak, of scientists and STEM learning and all of these things when we just produce nihilistic elements. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really kind of come down on one side or the other. It was probably kind of leaning towards nihilism is maybe not so great for our overall psyche. But I just think there's so many great things about shows like Star Trek, even things like Star Wars or what have you, that deal with the hopefulness. But I think if you're a realist, like I'm sure a lot of you are out there because you love horror films, there's also so much darkness in this world. So you kind of have to temper the two. Mm-hmm. It's not all going to be like, I don't know, Worf hanging out with Deanna Troi.
Yeah. God.
Even though they were a great couple,
no,
from what I remember.
No, they weren't.
They weren't? Oh, then I remembered incorrectly.
Oh,
was she meant to be with Riker?
No. She was meant to be alone forever. No, it's not her. It's Worf getting all these hotties and having them, oh, come on, Worf, experience a single emotion other than toxic masculinity, and him being like, no, he really drives me nuts. And I hear what you're saying. The next generation is so almost cloyingly optimistic. Like, no matter how brutal the storyline is, it always ends with a nice bow. Deep Space Nine was more political, so there was more kind of difficult decisions. And then Voyager right now, which I'm watching, and if you're not familiar with the setup, they are lost in space. They are lost in the deepest reaches of space, and they are having to make impossible, horrible decisions. And amid all this, there's the first TV Star Trek captain who is female, and so she has to deal with kind of people undermining her and asserting herself as a female leader. It's fascinating, and I have a feeling I'm going to bring up an episode or two when we get into these things, but let's get into them.
All right. Well, the first film we're going to talk about is Paul W.S. Anderson's Event Horizon. So he had just come right off of Mortal Kombat. It was pre-Resident Evil. Let's get into it. 1997's Event Horizon.
This morning, TDRS picked up an automated navigation beacon broadcasting at 2-minute intervals in Neptune orbit.
This is incredible. The Event Horizon. She's come back.
The Event Horizon is the culmination of a secret government project to create a spacecraft capable of faster-than-light flight. The ship doesn't really go faster than light. What it does is it creates a dimensional gateway that allows it to jump instantaneously from one point of the universe to another light years away.
Where has she been for the last 7 years, Doctor?
That's what we're here to find out. After 7 years in deep space,
there were 18 people on board this ship when it disappeared. I want them all accounted for.
Opening outer door.
It came back abandoned.
Any crew?
Negative. This place is a tomb.
But it didn't come back alone.
Captain Miller! I've got some problems here!
This ship has been beyond the boundaries of our universe. Who knows where it's been? And what it's brought back with it?
Did you hear that? What is it?
The
the ship is reacting to us and the reactions are getting stronger.
What are you telling me? That this ship is alive?
Oh. I have such wonderful things to show you.
Oh my God.
It knows my secrets. It knows my fears.
Vacate. I want off this ship.
You can't leave. She won't let you. God help us.
When a distress signal is received from the Event Horizon, a ship that disappeared 7 years before, it is up to the crew of the Lewis and Clark ship and Dr. Weir, who has joined them for this particular mission, to investigate what has happened to this ship in the intervening years. Weir reveals that he is the architect of the Event Horizon and tells the crew about its experimental gravity drive, which was meant to revolutionize space travel by condensing the space between two points. The crew boards the Event Horizon and things become increasingly odd, with crew members having violent and realistic visions. The crew soon discovers that when attempting its initial jump, the Event Horizon somehow passed through a hell dimension and has become sentient, destroying the Event Horizon's initial crew, and now is determined to destroy the crew of the Lewis and Clark, claiming it as its new crew. The crew decides to blow up the hyperdrive and escape. The visions take control of Weir, who becomes bent on taking the crew to hell with the Event Horizon while killing them off one by one. The Lewis and Clark's captain, Miller, sacrifices himself, allowing the few remaining crew members to escape in the lifeboat part of the Event Horizon. Although, who knows how much they actually escaped. So, this is a weird, pulpy, strange, out there film. It is kind of big and bombastic and Hollywood, but it is also much more cerebral than you would expect, I think, in a lot of these situations. And I like that it has that dichotomy of being really over the top in so many ways, but dealing with really deep personal trauma in a lot of other ways.
Mm-hmm. And full disclosure, Alex and I recently did a gig.
Yeah,
let's call it a gig. We had a gig at Queen's University, where a listener of ours is a PhD candidate and a graduate student, and his name is Dan, and he invited us out to talk to his film studies class. He teaches a course on horror and contemporary horror, and so we decided to talk about Event Horizon. We knew that we were going to be covering it in an upcoming episode. We knew that it's the kind of film that the younger generation might not be aware of, because I don't know about you, I only saw this film for the first time within the past 5 years, I think. I placed the timeline in the last 5 years because I was bartending at Nocturne on Queen Street West at the time, and the party was called Event Horizon, and there was like big monitors behind me. So I'm bartending away, and every so often I would glance behind me and I would see Weir with his eyes cut out, and I would see this space travel, and I would see Julie Richardson, and I'd be like, what is this film and how have I not seen it? And I checked it out right away and I was like, wow, how did this get past me?
I think I saw it pretty soon after it came out. Like, I feel like the TBS Superstation that we got here in Toronto showed a really cut down version of it.
Okay.
So I probably caught it on TV several times, eventually rented it, so I saw as much of the final cut as exists, the theatrical release. And I've always kind of harbored a soft spot for it. And it's one of those films that the older I got, the more into the community I got, I was really heartened to know that it has such a big cult following and that it has a lot of love for it. And that's kind of one of the things that was interesting about doing this Queen's talk, when I kind of said to this, you know, group of, I think there are third and fourth year students, like, hey, so it's cool to watch a contemporary horror film, and then realize that I don't think any of them had been born in 1997.
No, no, they definitely didn't consider it contemporary.
That was a sobering moment. And I think it was also, I'm glad we showed that, because they had been watching in this horror course a lot of great horror classics like Carrie, Get Out, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Silence of the Lambs, all of these things, because they're really focusing on gender and race and a kind of intersectional approach to horror, which is super, super cool.
So rad.
So then to show them Event Horizon and be like, this is also part of the canon.
Yeah.
This is also part of it. You can go as highbrow as, you know, Carrie and Get Out, but we also live in a space where it is pulpy, populace fun.
Mm-hmm. And we can pull just as interesting insights out of it. And they were totally on board. They were such a bright group, and they really charged my brain, so to speak. Like, oh, yeah, it was cool to dip into that world again.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that Paul W.S. Anderson, he talks quite openly about how much freedom he had with this film.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had just come off of Mortal Kombat, and which was his second film after his first film, Shopping. And Mortal Kombat was a huge success. Okay. It did really, really well. And he was looking for something quite dark. He and his producing partner, they wanted to do something dark and fucked up and really kind of change the tone, because Mortal Kombat is really like a kid's film, mm-hmm. essentially. And so what they did was they kind of put a call out. They eventually found this script called Event Horizon. And it had some similarities to what we see on screen, but it was about the ship that traveled through a dimension and came back, and the crew that went to go to save them, they were having visions and things were going wrong and they couldn't quite explain it. And then in the end, it was this big tentacled alien monster mm-hmm. that was doing all of it. And what Paul W.S. Anderson wanted to do was strip it back and create something along the lines of The Shining or The Haunting, and create that kind of terror in space, but really make it a haunted house film mm-hmm. in space. And what I like about that is it really ratchets up that tension. You know, there's always that sense of if you're in a haunted house film, just run out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of haunted house films and ghost films tackle that by, you know, making the ghosts omnipresent or however they want to do it. But here it's, you know, they really explore the tension of space.
Yeah.
Inside you are safe, in a spacesuit you are safe, but don't let yourself get out of that airlock, Justin.
Oh, yeah. Justin.
Hang on, baby bear. So it's, I actually thought it was quite a smart decision to take a lot of the themes and tropes that they were appreciating from other subgenres mm-hmm. and mold them into something new. And by doing so, I think that's why Event Horizon still feels quite fresh and unexpected mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, because there isn't a clear-cut answer
right.
in the end of what this thing is.
No, indeed. I mean, you could call them plot holes. You could definitely call them plot holes. And I've only identified them looking at this film as deeply as I have, both for that Queen's talk and for this episode. It doesn't really subscribe to the rules of science fiction that I was talking about. It doesn't really follow its own rules that it lays out, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But at the same time, it is so watchable. It is so much fun. There's very interesting themes going on. And I think in stripping away the monster, it just really lended so much emphasis to the atmosphere and the architecture of the ship, which are unparalleled. The Lewis and Clark and the Event Horizon have really gothic, crazy architecture. And yet, you go along with it. You're like, okay, that's science that I don't understand, so that exists there, and it looks like that, and that's just fine.
Yeah, and even in the set design, you know, Paul W.S. Anderson worked with a young production designer, and they really wanted that gothic feel. I mean, the Event Horizon is designed very similar to Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yeah, those vaulted ceilings.
The vaulted ceilings, but even like the long body and the pods and mm-hmm. the way it's all laid out. And what's great about that is visually, even if you don't have that knowledge of it's Notre Dame Cathedral, it does look like an inverted cross
mm-hmm.
or a regular cross, depending on which angle it's shot from.
Hey, yeah.
And it's just a nice visual cue that you
yep.
get. And even throughout the sloped ceilings of the spaceship, and even that window, like the kind of clear glass that looks like a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the opening images, is this lifeless body. You don't quite know what it is yet, like floating in air, and like it looks like Jesus on a cross.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the themes, which we'll get into soon, of Catholicism and Catholic guilt are so at the forefront of this film.
Yes.
And it's, to me, a film about guilt and regret and figuring out how to make amends.
Yeah. Which is kind of hilarious, because this film, again, similarly to The Thing, was a huge box office flop, was a huge production nightmare. The story behind this is it's the same studio that was making Titanic, and Titanic was its own production nightmare. James Cameron was James Cameroning out all over everything, and it was delayed, and so they had this budget, but Event Horizon had a very abbreviated time frame with which to shoot and edit. And when we're talking about a science fiction film where there's space and some pretty high-tech special effects stuff going on at the time, that time was really crunched, and it shows. It's part of the reason why this film feels a little bit uneven. It's one of the imperfections that, in my opinion, is easily overlooked for the overall creativity of the film, but they're there. We should also mention that the original cut of the film was 130 minutes long, and that screened for test audiences who hated it. The test audiences saw a version that had the visual effects weren't all finished, the music wasn't all finished, but that's not what drove them nuts. It was the gore. It was the violent, sexy, hellraisery sequences that they didn't like. And so the final cut that we know was cut down from 130 minutes to 95 minutes, which excised not only some of the gore, but also a bunch of the story and tension. And Anderson himself, if you hear him talk about this film, he expresses great regret at the fact that he was promised that this excised footage would wind up on the DVD, and it was lost.
It's interesting to hear Anderson talk about this film in particular because overall he's quite an eloquent guy. He speaks quite passionately and fondly about almost any of his films that he's involved in, which is frankly, I think, what you want from a director. But in this one, when I was watching all the making ofs and the amount he divulged about this, mm-hmm. he still speaks about the film with great affection. Mm-hmm. It's not the film he necessarily wanted in the end, but he still really likes this film, mm-hmm. and he's still proud to put his name and his effort and time behind it. Yeah. And another thing he mentioned was, even though the time got crunched, particularly in post-production, even though it was overall kind of a hard shoot, he talked about how amazing the atmosphere was on set, how everyone really got along, they had a good time, there was a real camaraderie, that everyone wanted to come together and make this the best film they could, mm-hmm. which I think you feel. You feel like these people are really interacting with each other. And mm-hmm. I think it helps when you have particularly really strong performances from Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Neill. Mm-hmm. You know, and Sam Neill had kind of had a bit of a North American, I don't even know if you can say renaissance, because I don't know how big he was before that, truly.
Right.
He was kind of a cult actor in my mind, but after Jurassic Park, he was kind of the lead in that. And he really sells this, like, sad, tortured man who becomes a dark and demented pinhead hell priest.
Yeah, well, they sell a really pulpy script. And when we were showing it to that third year class, there were titters, there were giggles mm-hmm. that I was kind of, I'm always a little bit defensive. Every time I program a screening and there are laughs where I don't expect, I'm like, ah, fuck, they hate this. This is the worst. They don't appreciate it. But the script is bad. Justin.
Mama Bear. I will also say this is probably my favorite film predicated on a lack of basic knowledge of Latin grammar.
Is that a long list of
yep.
all the films that are predicated on a lack of?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Is Latin incorrect? Is that why you're saying that?
Yeah.
Is it really?
Well, no. J.D. fucks it up.
Oh, yes. His initial interpretation. Yeah. Which I don't know how he pulled that out of that clip. Let me just say.
He's got those great Jason Isaac ears. So, speaking of everyone's favorite dead language, Latin, as some of you might know, it is the liturgy of Mass in the Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. Now, that, I think, speaks a lot into some of the overall Catholic themes, as I was mentioning before with them, not only the visual imagery, but also the themes of guilt. Now, the themes of guilt come through most strongly in three characters. There's Captain Miller, played by Lawrence Fishburne, and he confesses at one point during the film that he had to leave a crew member behind to die in order to save the rest of his crew in a past mission. Then, of course, there is Peters, who's played by Kathleen Quinlan, and she's the kind of mother figure on the ship. She's one of the doctors, and she constantly has these flashes and visions of her sick child, who she cannot go back to Earth to see because she was called up for this mission, mm-hmm. even though Miller tried to get her out of it. And then, of course, the big one is Weir. This is something we see right off the top in this film. His wife committed suicide. And as it's kind of revealed through the film, she committed suicide. It's hinted at, strongly hinted at, because he was paying more attention to his work, we can assume on the event horizon, mm-hmm. which he was the architect of, rather than to her. Mm-hmm. And so she ended her own life. The visions of her, she appears naked because she slit her wrist in the bathtub. And, you know, she appears to him saying, I'm cold, I'm so alone. And this is really interesting because she's speaking in the present tense to him. Mm-hmm. And so it's that her suffering has not ended. Mm-hmm. Not, I was so cold. Mm-hmm. I was so alone. It's, I am. Mm-hmm. Again, these verbs, these tenses, so important in this film. Now, I'm kind of utilizing the phrase Catholic guilt, not only because certainly in white North American Western culture, it's kind of a big de facto saying, you know, you're plagued with Catholic guilt. I happen to know a lot of lapsed Catholics. My father is one. And that's the notion that Jesus died for the sins of man. Yet, because we continue to sin, we are betraying his mercy and absolution. So that is why we, you know, go to confession. That is why we go to church. That is whatever, whatever. Essentially, we're constantly trying to make amends for the things that we do, big, small, in between. Mm. Now, what's interesting is that Weir can't overcome his guilt. The wife constantly returns to him again and again throughout the film. And it culminates in like one of the most horrifying scenes in the film when she's behind the glass and it all explodes mm-hmm. and it all goes really haywire at that point. And the Event Horizon becomes really powerful and really begins to take over. And that is the point when Weir succumbs to the Event Horizon, in my opinion. He does not overcome it. He becomes part of it, essentially becoming its mouthpiece in a lot of ways, kind of like Pinhead.
Right.
And this we can see in that the wife kind of goes for his eyes and then cuts to him ripping his own eyes out.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that harkened a bit back to Greek mythology, which I studied in particular when I was in theater school because, you know, so many Greek plays. Mm-hmm. And really bringing it back to the myth of Oedipus. And of course, we all know Oedipus is the guy who fucks his mom, blah, blah, blah. But Oedipus actually plucks out his own eyes over guilt and succumbing to his own fate. He, at this point in the play and the story, he thinks he's overcome it. He thinks he's beat fate. But it comes known to him that he's not. And his mother slash wife finds out and she goes off and kills herself. He goes and finds her. He's racked with guilt and he plucks his own eyes out with her brooch.
Hmm.
And it has to do with guilt. It has to do with succumbing to his fate mm-hmm. and giving up and not wanting to see and becoming, you know, this kind of blind beggar that exists in this world. And honestly, taking away a lot of agency. And that for me is Weir giving himself over to the Event Horizon. Miller, on the other hand, outwardly confesses what happened. Mm-hmm. He sees this fallen crew member in Korik, this vision that appears to him, and he's so upset, he actually confesses it to a fellow crew member, Smith. He feels horrible, he's guilt-ridden, and he seems to try to kind of take some responsibility. I could have done something, I could have changed it, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is really important in the flip side to what Weir does is Miller ultimately sacrifices himself.
Mm-hmm.
He takes on that place. He sees through the visions of the Event Horizon and says, you know, essentially, not this time, fucker.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have, it's a more traumatic experience of guilt. And I think it seems in a lot of ways a kind of guilt without meaning, especially when Weir and Miller have such deep meanings with guilt.
Mm-hmm.
They represent two sides of a coin. So if they represent two sides of a coin, then maybe we can look at Peter's representing the in-between. She is the way that guilt distracts us,
mm.
you know, because she's on her way out. She's like, I'm going to fucking get out of this ship. And then she sees her son.
Right.
And it leads her down a corridor. So it leads her off her path and she just dies.
Right.
She does not get reborn. She does not, you know, become, you know, Lady Cenobite of Event Horizon. She is just dead.
Right. Yeah, I found it kind of weird because, like you, I looked at Weir and Miller as opposite sides of the same coin, and they've got their personal backstory, and that's included. Then Peters gets this backstory, which feels to me kind of incomplete. Like, you get the sense that her son is paraplegic, mm-hmm. and then when she has visions, she's seeing her son with his legs rotting
yeah.
and infested with maggots and stuff. So she has this history, and then it doesn't really come to a head, and none of the other crew has their kind of personal back history dragged into it. So yeah, that's interesting that you position her as kind of an in-between. That makes sense.
Well, and I think if also you look at the character of Justin, aka Baby Bear,
mm-hmm.
The young crew member who first gets subsumed by the Event Horizon mm-hmm. hyperdrive, and then they pull him out and he's just gone. He's gone. He's in a state of shock. They don't know if he's ever going to come out of it. Then you have the terrifying scene with the airlock,
mm-hmm.
which again is just, oh, God.
It's really effective.
It's so effective. I truly think that's such a great scene. The timing, the pacing, the editing of it, it really comes together quite well. He says, you know, when he kind of comes to at one point that the Event Horizon, the hyperdrive, showed him the dark place inside. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of signals that even if there wasn't an overt one for him or some of the other crew members like J.D. Smith, Stark, somewhere in there, we all have darkness.
In everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I did manage to come across a script for Event Horizon, and I found this link, and I'll share it in the course notes because I was just like, holy shit, is this going to fill in all of these plot holes? Is this going to make everything make sense? And there wasn't a whole lot. There was an extra scene with Weir meeting with an admiral to dispatch the mission where Weir insists on going himself, even though everyone recognizes he shouldn't. A couple of admirals talk about it. And, oh, he's too close to the material. And plus, there was that horrible thing with his wife. But yeah, let's send him anyway. But with regard to what you were saying, it's interesting that Miller comes to Smith as a confessional, because another deleted scene involved a conversation between Smith and Miller about how Event Horizon's technology is wrong and how it goes too far. Mm. And then later, Smith has a conversation with Cooper where he mentions the Tower of Babel. So Smith was depicted in this version of the script anyway as kind of a confessional, a kind of a spiritual hub that people come to. And then he's the one who lets out these interesting religious insights into everything that's going on. And the only other interesting takeaway I had from that particular version of the script, and again, I'll link to it so that you can check it out yourself, but there was details on the orgy.
Ooh.
So if you'll permit me a little bit of sci-fi porn in this here episode, I will read an excerpt. One man dislocates his shoulder with a wet popping sound, wet popping as in caps, as he shoves his arm down his own throat. Blood bubbles from his nose. With a shucking sound, he pulls his stomach out of his mouth. Behind him, a man and woman fuck. Man and woman are in caps because they're roles, you know? Mm. Covered with blood. She bites through his neck. His head lolls to the other side. She buries her face in the torn flesh as he thrusts into her again and again and again. That's what we missed, guys. Sorry about it.
Well, we do see some of that stuff.
Yeah, snippets of it. There was also a snippet of Stark getting tied up naked with barbed wire, which was interesting because she didn't, I don't know, I feel like she, out of all of them, she kind of got out easy. She got out at all, first of all.
But she's also the one that's kind of infected with the madness at the end.
That's true.
Because Cooper's kind of been outside of the Event Horizon for a lot of the plot and then just kind of comes back in at the end. But there is a sense I get at the end that somehow the Event Horizon, the life ship, whatever they're in, has sunk its teeth, especially into Stark.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they're the two to survive because they had not sexual tension, but there was like sexual banter in the beginning. So it would almost like, I don't know, if they were the last two to be trapped somewhere to repopulate the Earth or whatever, it would have been a hilarious Adam and Eve setup. I feel like the inclusion of sex in the violence, the inclusion of sex in this movie at all, really once again prays back to the classic Christian guilt, where sex is something that is dirty and repressed and just as loathsome as violence.
I always feel like that's a thing when you set up a sci-fi film, a sci-fi horror film, you're going to have a mixed crew. Hopefully. You want a diverse crew, especially to represent our world and our population. And there always has to be some kind of address of how do you handle that sexual tension. Mm-hmm. You know, even in most of our workplaces, you know, we have sexual harassment suits and laws and all kinds of things to protect people. And I thought it was a really intense depiction of this kind of sexual wildness that just overtakes them. Mm-hmm. Like it's almost the first thing they go to, sex and violence.
At the same time.
Yeah. But it's consensual. I mean, they're possessed, but it's consensual, so.
Consenting to being bitten in the neck while you're...
Well, he's still thrusting, so, you know.
While we're on the topic of Christianity, it's so interesting the way this film deals with the topic of hell. And I wrote a paper on hell as it pertains to Hellraiser, not that long ago, and so hell was kind of fresh in my mind as a lapsed Catholic that I am as well. And the hell that we're seeing in Event Horizon isn't a particularly Christian version of hell in that there's no judgment and there's no reckoning of any sort. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Welcome to hell. It's the fucking Event Horizon. Even Hellraiser has some kind of like murky politic with you called us and we came. And even if you didn't mean it, well, then maybe there's some negotiation to happen. But there's no sparing of the good or the innocent. There's no pearly gates to be dealt with first. And there's also no real redemption to be had. I feel like Event Horizon kind of uses hell as like a vague descriptor of a place where terrible things happen without any real point to it. I think it was utilized, again, as the counterpoint to the Christian guilt thing. Mm. So it made sense. But in the same vein, there are no demons or beings. There's just possession and manipulation and visions more akin to The Shining. And you don't even really get a sense of what the Event Horizon wants. You know, like some haunted houses want to be solved like a Rubik's Cube. They want to be satisfied. They want their mysteries discovered.
Weir kind of mentions, as he succumbs to the Event Horizon, he mentions that she wants a new crew.
A new crew, yeah.
And it's like, oh, did she wear the crew out because the sex was too rough?
Yeah.
You know, like.
It was. Wallpapered the walls with their flesh.
Yeah. That's an interesting idea, that there is this kind of non-linear, non-specific hell. And I feel like as much as this film kind of apes towards an understanding of Catholic guilt and Catholicism in very certain ways, it kind of just places hell as like evil, evil. It doesn't have that, you know, notion of hell is this and it's not that, but it is this and this and this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you made a really interesting point when we were at Queens, is that hell is often conceived of as something deep in the earth, something underground, a place that's hot.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting to posit it as an outer space, outer space, the coldest, most inaccessible region.
Yeah, well, I mean, for so long, you know, even in our most early days as a human society, through medieval times, which was dark Catholic times, like Christian warfare times, heaven was a place among the stars. Mm-hmm. That is where God is. Even when you're a little kid, oftentimes you get told that's where you go. You're up in the clouds. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. And hell is hot and deep and dark and earthy and all of these things with pitchforks. And so for hell to be very placed within a dimension in outer space feels quite subversive and quite different. And I think that's what makes it kind of unexpected and keeps the film fresh. Even if it doesn't fully articulate and explore what hell is, it is a very interesting idea to me.
Oh, yeah. And it's congruent within itself. Like, hell is a place where you cut yourself and you fuck yourself to death and you gouge out your eyes. Like, there are consistencies within these people's experience of hell.
So in between heaven and hell and medieval times and all of this stuff that's going on in Event Horizon, you know, like fucking Monty Python and the Holy Grail, we have to deal with something that Andrea has kind of alluded to already in some of the stuff she's brought up, which is the science of it and who creates science but a scientist. And to me, Dr. Weir in this film is a really interesting example of the quote-unquote mad scientist, which we are so privy to in the horror film and very privy to in the kind of 1950s atomic age schlocky B-movies that were really popular in America. And mad scientists have existed since the inception of science fiction, of course, most notably with the character of Victor Frankenstein in Frankenstein. They've gone on and on. There are so many different examples, some really amazing examples in film. And there's so much suspicion around science and scientists because they are reshaping life. They are changing it. Yes, they're doing it for the better, but do we really know that? And especially in the 20th century, kind of the atomic age and beyond, there was so much fear around nuclear weapons, the Cold War, and then even localized into government instability, things that were used in warfare. Like, scientists were developing things that were meant to keep us safe, but hurting people just in a different country.
Yeah.
And that is super problematic and scary and terrifying. So you're dealing with a lot of those things, and those themes kind of come out again in the films I mentioned before. Also in things like 2001 Space Odyssey, The Andromeda Strain, all of these things that kind of, you know, go through the 70s, even in something like The Fly, with a scientist kind of experimenting on himself and the body horror of that, particularly in the Cronenberg version. And then we get to the 90s. And I found this book called Mad, Bad, and Dangerous, The Scientist in the Cinema. And I'll link that in the show notes. And in this book, the author talks about the Einstein paradox. Nice man, nasty applications. Mm. So good guy with good ideas, but they were all used for terrifying outcomes in a lot of ways. And so that kind of speaks to the inadvertent evil that I was mentioning just before. As scientists strive to create things that will make our lives better, make them easier, faster, and while they're well-intentioned, the application can fault them. So they use the example of, again, Jurassic Park, where it is the entrepreneurial science and the scientist that is using something to create business. Mm-hmm. So it's not the notion that the Frankenstein monster is bad and an abomination and creates all these moral complex issues. It's that, oh, we can box and sell Frankenstein monsters wholesale. We can create monstrosity to sell it. And I think that's really interesting when applied to Event Horizon and Dr. Weir. He was simply creating something to help space travel, as he so helpfully points out with the piece of paper and the pencil.
Still trying to bend my head around that.
But in doing something to solve a major issue in space travel, which apparently is 30-odd years out from in 2047, as this film takes place in, it all goes horribly wrong. And it goes horribly wrong because of business. And I think you even see a little bit of that in the – actually, you see quite a bit of that in the Alien franchise, where they're trying to harvest the xenomorphs as a kind of weaponized entity. And in this one, you have something that is well-intentioned, but it almost works too well. And it falls apart in the unknown, the one thing you can't account for. And I think that's really interesting. And I think the commodification of science is something really fascinating because, again, as we were talking about Star Trek and the wanting to go to the stars and learn more and explore and all of these noble, rich ideas, there is always a bottom line. And you don't ever really, certainly that I remember, talk about the financial bottom line of this Star Trek Federation or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, that's the one thing that they really did away with in the Star Trek universe was money. And it came back a little bit in Deep Space Nine because there's different cultures involved. But yeah, without money, there's a lot less conflict in the universe. So the idea of the noble endeavor of space and how space can help humanity and how a mission, the most noble of missions, can go completely awry dovetails nicely into the next film that we're going to talk about. But before we get there, I had a couple of questions for you, because sometimes you pick up on things that I don't pick up on, and I know our listeners probably have some questions about this film. Maybe they scratched their head at some of the same things I did. Maybe there are no answers to these questions, and that's okay, but I'm going to ask them. The warp core, it turns itself off and on. Is there any point to it being off or on? Like, it seems to me that the apparitions appear all the time. They're intensified when it's turned on, but
My sense of it was that it was activating itself when it had human bodies to deal with and human memories and things that it could feed off of.
So it was mostly just like, I'm activated because I'm hungry.
I sense trauma. Here's something I can fuck with. Otherwise, like, I'm going to take a nap.
All right. I'll accept that. I feel like it had visual cue, like, you know, the rings would line up and it would flash and it would be like, oh, it's turning on. And every single time I watch it, I try to figure out what exactly prompted that moment.
And I have to say, like, I know there's a lot of post-production issues on this film, as we've talked about. And, you know, especially some of that eye CGI is especially dodgy. But that kind of warp core thing, like, it's impressive.
Yeah, it looked cool. That whole room looked
still
really cool.
Like, still very impressive.
So the warp core itself, did you understand it as a portal or an engine? Because it's weird that it is technology that can pull the ship through a black hole, but it's also kind of a black hole itself in that Justin travels through it to the other dimension and comes back all fucked up.
Yeah, my sense was that it was supposed to create kind of a hole that the whole ship could go through and go to like 3 million light years away, whatever it is, but that also it's evil, so it can just do whatever the fuck it wants now.
Okay, last question. The crew of the Lewis and Clark, some of them get these personalized visions to torment them. I feel like you already answered this. Were the crew of the Event Horizon obsessed with orgy guilt and ocular trauma, or was that just a Catholic guilt blanket thing?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because you don't ever get to see the crew of the Lewis and Clark reach that extent. But the original crew of the Event Horizon did. So they got to the kind of the most extreme place, the place where Weir kind of was, I felt.
Right.
So they were all in it and they were all just like fucking each other and going crazy. But the crew of the Lewis and Clark had enough kind of humanity or wherewithal or fear of what was going on to kind of hold back and not give in to it. So I don't know, maybe they were just more complex, better written characters.
All right. Well, I think we need to make a second podcast called Alex Explains Movies.
I really like this game. This is fun.
I wish I came up with more because there's probably more plot holes. But, you know, like, again, all this to say, when I say plot hole, they're not flaws.
When I say plot hole, you say good.
Plot hole.
Good.
Plot hole.
Good. You know, and I will say this slightly off topic. I don't hate a plot hole.
No.
Occasionally there are some when I'm watching a movie and I'm watching it for the first time and I see them and they don't get addressed and it's just that grates me.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are ones like this where I can kind of think back and I'm like, yeah, that's not quite explained. And like, those are all great questions and I can kind of come up with an answer, but who fucking knows if they're right or not? I'm just...
Well, yeah. Sometimes there'll be a plot hole and the answer to it will be a missing piece that'll illuminate a bunch of things.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case here. Although I do think that there is a loose thread in a pendant that Miller wears around his neck. And you brought this up in Kingston as well. And it wasn't in the script draft that I read. I wasn't able to find any information
on it. I didn't see it expressly addressed in the stuff I watched to prep for this episode. So it appears that Miller is wearing like an African flag.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of a pendant or something. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting.
And he clutches it sometimes in times of stress.
Yeah, and it feels quite powerful because when you're looking for those little things in a film to kind of analyze it and take it apart, those little things start like really screaming to you. And there was something in one of the interviews Paul W.S. Anderson did, and he was talking about how he felt a lot of freedom to make this film, and he could kind of cast who he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he had British actors, he had American actors, he had a New Zealand actor and Sam Neill, and the studio was fine with his idea and instinct to just let them all speak in their normal accents.
Right.
So I think it was just the sense of having, you know, if we're going to have a diverse crew, let's not make them all American. Let's, you know, this is the future. This is countries collaborating for this kind of mission.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it has to be. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the closest I got to it. And I kind of like that reading that that's who Miller is.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, a Black American man and has ties to his heritage.
Yeah.
And I think just to kind of wrap up the discussion of this film, we should just kind of call out some of the name of the ship and what and who they are. So the Event Horizon is actually a scientific term, which means essentially in layman's terms, point of no return. And I know that because I looked up what it meant and there was a whole scientific explanation and then it just said in layman's terms. And I was like, boom.
I'll take those.
Done. Sold. Which is great because that's kind of the point of no return and seems like a fucked up thing to name your ship. And then, of course, there is the rescue ship and the rescue crew, and they are on the Lewis and Clark. And Lewis and Clark were two very famous explorers who scouted the western frontier of America during the terrible and violent nation building that was done there, but has been largely sanitized. So there's that. And speaking of space and a point of no return.
And very unfortunate ship names.
We're going to hop onto another ship and check out Danny Boyle's 2007 film, Sunshine.
Our sun is dying. Mankind faces extinction. 16 months ago, I, Robert Capa, and a crew of seven left Earth frozen in a solar winter. Our mission, reignite the sun before it's too late. Welcome to Icarus 2. So if you wake up one morning and it's a particularly beautiful day, you'll know we made it.
It's the year 2057 and the sun is dying out, so a crew of eight are sent to detonate a nuclear bomb in the sun to reignite it. The crew of the Icarus II are well underway when they receive a distress beacon from the Icarus I, a ship that set off for the same mission 7 years earlier and never returned. They decide to alter their course to rendezvous with the Icarus I in the hopes of doubling their chance of success with two nukes instead of one. In so doing, their navigator, Trey, makes an error in realigning their solar shield, causing a depletion of the ship's oxygen reserves and the death of their captain while he makes repairs. Once aboard the Icarus I, the crew discovers that the ship's captain, Pinbacker, aborted their mission and sabotaged their ship's ability to deliver the bomb, believing that God intended to end the human race and they shouldn't go against his will. They recover the bomb, losing several crew members in the process, and resume their mission for the sun, aware that they don't have enough oxygen for all the remaining crew members to complete the mission, much less get back home. When the ship's computer informs them that there's an unidentified person aboard the ship, they discover that a heavily burned Pinbacker has boarded the Icarus II and is intent on making sure they don't dispatch the bomb. So, I didn't name names in the synopsis, but I feel like it's really significant that Sunshine boasts a very diverse crew, and Event Horizon had a crew along these same lines where, you know, there was a pilot, there was a doctor, there was someone in charge of rescue, there was a commander. In this film, we have a physicist named Kappa, played by Cillian Murphy, Mace, the engineer, Cassie, the pilot, Corazon, a biologist, a doctor named Searle, Garrity, who is second in command, Kaneda, the captain, and Trey, the navigator. And one of the most significant things about Sunshine, I think, is the inclusion of a biologist, first of all, as they have this lovely green room. The ship is very self-sustaining in that it's powered by solar energy, which is abundant, obviously, where they are. The oxygen is being reproduced, water is being recycled, and even their doctor has psychoanalytic chops. You know, they're very in tune with the mental stresses of this mission.
And I think it's also notable in the diverse backgrounds of the crew of this ship, because both the captain and Trey, the navigator, are Asian, and Danny Boyle, the director, has kind of gone on record to talk about how if this mission were going to happen in the future, it would have to be led particularly by China, due to their resources and what they have. So it would have to be a kind of full worldwide effort, but again, kind of centered within Asian countries.
And also, I think it's interesting that when we talked about this when we talked about Alien, and this happens again with the Event Horizon, is the crew has a very grunt feeling to it. It almost feels like a wrecking crew. It almost feels like a group of truckers, you know? They're rough around the edges. They talk shit. They smoke. They drink. Whereas in Sunshine, you really get the sense that this is humanity's best and brightest. Indeed, it's humanity's last hope. So it kind of makes sense. And it's more analogous to who we send into space nowadays. Like NASA is, you know, the absolutely most qualified people. And so this crew looks very different from sci-fi horror that we often see. And the camaraderie between the cast is tremendous once again. And Danny Boyle employed a very kind of method acting scenario to this film where the actors were assigned to live together. I think they lived together for over a year. They took space training classes together. They took scuba diving classes together to deal with the zero gravity scenes. And that camaraderie really shows.
And I think it's also important to note as we get started on this conversation that while this is a Danny Boyle film, he was just coming off of 28 Days Later, the kind of one of the big kickoffs of the zombie resurgence in the new millennium. And this was his second collaboration with the writer Alex Garland, who wrote 28 Days Later. He wrote Sunshine. And then he's gone on to have a pretty prolific science fiction career on his own with Ex Machina and now Annihilation, which is a pretty... I don't even have words to describe Annihilation right now, having just seen it. It's pretty epic.
It's pretty epic. It's pretty ambitious. It was a production disaster and a whole lot of drama with the studio that, you know, maybe it'll get an episode of its own one day. Who knows? We don't know. We'll save it for there.
again, it's another collaboration between these two. And Danny Boyle has talked about how he feels like often a lot of directors will do one science fiction film and that's it, because it's too hard.
So punishing.
It is so punishing, from not only the creation of it, the making of it, the post-production of it, to the marketing of it. Mm-hmm. And again, like Event Horizon, this film was a flop. This was a flop, and I think there's a lot of expectations on it because there was such a genre resurgence with 28 Days Later. Mm-hmm. And that film, like, I remember people talking about it. I remember going to see it in theaters. I remember going to see it in a packed theater mm-hmm. in downtown Toronto when it came out. And then I went to see Sunshine because I was like, ooh, it has an Event Horizon-y vibe. This will be cool. And I remember going to see it with my dad, and there were maybe three other people yeah. in the cinema. And that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you saw it on its original theatrical run.
Yes. And I was pretty blown away by it. I still am. This film is like all of my anxieties pushed into one mm-hmm. film. It is so white-knuckling to watch this film for mm-hmm. me. It's I think, really successful in so many ways. And I really do love this film top to bottom. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people will say, I love Sunshine until. And it's always they get to the third act when Pinbacker shows up. And then yeah. they're like, then it just turns into a fucking slasher or Event Horizon. And I don't give a shit anymore. Yeah. And I don't mind it. I don't know if the third act is the best done out of all of it. Mm-hmm. But I still really like it, and I like the story and where it goes.
Yeah.
I think my problem with the third act has to do with the portrayal of Pinbacker,
right.
where it gets very haphazard as to where he is, what he's doing, and like his own, like the visual style of him. It's like he's on fire and it's crazy.
He's a human lens flare.
Yeah, and it gets very disorienting to watch, and not the good kind of disorienting where you're like, oh, this film has thrown me off kilter. The film has done that already. I just lose where people are in a scene.
Yeah. I felt like the third act kind of suffered from maybe a pacing issue mm-hmm. where, like, when you had glimpses of Pinbacker and he was, again, like, just kind of distorted, disfigured, you definitely got the sense that he was heavily burned all over. I think if they had have shot him straight, he would have looked weird and Freddy Krueger-y, and it just yep. wouldn't have worked. So I get why they did that, but they did kind of prolong those sequences of him glimmering, and yeah, it was kind of disorienting.
And as the other thing is, like, Pinbacker is played by an amazing actor, Mark Strong, a British actor, who's gone on to do a lot more. He was, I believe he was the villain in Kick-Ass.
Oh, okay.
And so he's one of those guys that if you look at his IMDb, you've probably seen him in some stuff.
Yeah.
And I've always seen him in like BBC dramas and British films. And he does have presence through this kind of nonsense of what's going on around mm-hmm. him. So I always just feel like, ah, oh, you had like almost the perfect actor to do it. So if yeah. you just kind of centered it a bit more, mm-hmm. then it would have been even more, it would have landed that ending more.
Right.
And then, of course, there are these strange theories that I read online. And someone posited a theory which pretty much got picked apart in the comments or on Reddit, wherever I read this, that Pinbacker didn't exist when he came back. It was actually Kappa who'd lost his mind and was
Whoa.
Destroying everything. But it kind of falls apart when you actually put it all together.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
Now, for myself, this movie completely missed it. Once again, just like Event Horizon, off my radar. I didn't know. And I even considered myself a fan of Danny Boyle. I'm very fond of 28 Days Later. I'm also fond of his more maligned output. I really loved The Beach.
And then he also has a lot of other amazing outputs. Like after Sunshine, he went on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture with Slumdog Millionaire. He has another film that I really love called Millions, which is actually a really sweet little film. And he's, you know, still making films. And, of course, in the 90s, he was incredibly well-known and made his mark with Trainspotting. Mm. And then a film before that, which I really love, called Shallow Grave. And then even in 2017, he made Trainspotting 2, mm-hmm. which if you haven't seen it and you like the first one, check it out because it is great. And he was just announced as being the director of the new James Bond film.
Huh. But in looking at his IMDb and considering myself a fan of his, I saw Sunshine and it didn't sound like a horror movie. And I hadn't heard it buzzed about within horror circles. So it completely got past me until earlier this year. My partner was just like, you haven't seen that? We should watch it. And it blew me away. And of course, I mentioned it to Alex. And then when we decided to do this episode, it seemed like the perfect pairing, which I think it is. I think the stories complement one another. I think the narratives compare and contrast in really interesting ways, which I'm looking forward to getting into. But I feel such tremendous poetry in Sunshine, and it's something that Danny Boyle is just able to do with these sequences and great use of music. And basically here we have this crew has everything. This ship has everything. Everything is so glossy and perfect and calculated for this very, very important mission. So when shit goes haywire, it goes haywire in the absolute worst way. And they're never, ever dealing with just one thing or another. It's always something catastrophic that has no simple solution. Like, what do you do when you don't have enough air for everyone?
And there's not a sense that, you know, oh, there are space stations all around them. You feel like they are truly out on their own. This is the last spaceship.
This is it.
That humanity has. Mm-hmm. They spend a lot on the first one. Who knows what the fuck happened to that?
Yeah.
We're going to find out. But here's the last one. So there's no one in between them and Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels truly alone. And then they even kind of get into the sun's radius even earlier than they thought. So they lose communication. And there is pretty devastating scene between Kappa and Mace when Kappa takes his time to, you know, talk to his family and send that last message back to Earth. And then when he gets out, they pass through that time when they can send messages back to Earth. So Mace has lost his chance to send something back. So he just starts beating the hell out of Kappa.
Yeah. And I feel like the film sets it up that they are going to be antagonists. They are ideologically opposed. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them is a physicist and Mace is the engineer. So they're already, you know, in completely different disciplines and completely different outlooks. And when you see them arguing about whether or not to intercept the Icarus One, both their sides are completely reasonable and rational.
And I have no idea where I would land. And I like that the film sets it up. So it gives you enough information to kind of say, like, what would you choose?
Mm-hmm.
And then when Kaneda kind of puts it to Kappa to make that choice, kind of saying, you know, you're the best person for this choice. I need you to do this.
Yeah.
He does. Kappa makes that choice, but you can tell he's not certain of it either.
No.
And he's then Mace, making the best call.
That's right. And then when Mace throws it in his face later, like, you're angry, but at the same time, you know that you do the same thing.
And for all of the amazing science that is on board this ship and the kind of intelligence and the dialogue that these characters have about these very same things, the margin for human error is so great to even the microscopic level.
That's so realistic. And that, again, harkens back to the plausibility. Like, so much of this technology is like, really? Like, do you even want to explain to me how this Earth room works? It's kind of like the Star Trek holosuite. Can you even explain the weird background that Kappa has when he's sending that message back home? Like, you roll with that, because then you've got this situation with Trey, who admits, like, I was doing 100,000 things and I was off by 1 point something millimeters when it comes to the shield. And in science, those little tiny errors are exactly what gets you.
And as someone, and Andrew, I think you're the same way, who beats themselves up over every tiny mistake, you just felt that. I felt like every part of Trey's, like, I fucked up.
Yeah.
And it's not just me fucking up, it's fucking up for the Earth.
Yeah.
And like, ugh.
And everything snowballed from there. And it wasn't entirely his fault, but you could really feel the sense that the weight of that was all on him and culminated in him doing what he had to do, which actually, to be fair, kind of solved a problem, the lack of oxygen.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. They had to draw straws, and he made that a little bit easier on them. But at the same time, this crew, like I said, absolutely devastating odds. The knowledge that they might not make it there, much less come back, they really take that on the chin, and it's brutal to watch.
Well, there's that part when Cassie says, I think, to Kappa, like, I know we're going to die out here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, yeah, but they still keep doing their jobs. They don't just lie down and give up. It's like, I need to do my job to the point where I think we can do this.
That's right. And she asks him, are you scared? And he kind of rattles off all this psycho science babble and is just like, we're going to do this and we're going to do this and we're going to pull this crazy fucking shit off. And no, I'm not scared. And indeed, you get the sense that this team, insofar as they're going on a doomed mission that may or may not work, the whole of humanity is resting on their shoulders. But you get the sense that they are so keen on science and they are so excited and they believe so much in what they're doing. I'm thinking of the scene where they all go into the observation room to check out Mercury.
Mm.
We're near Mercury, guys. Like, left, you will see. Yeah. And so they get so excited. They go running up to that. They're so invested in it and in the science of it and what they're doing. And again, that's in stark contrast from the Lewis and Clark crew who are just like, we're supposed to be on leave. Let's get this the fuck over with.
And I like that the kind of amazing advances that they have in their science lead to a kind of unnaturalness within the film. So obviously, you know, the ship's names, again, we're talking about dodgy ship names. So you've got the Icarus 1 and the Icarus 2. And oh, Icarus is, of course, from the Greek mythology of the guy who had the wax wings and flew too close to the sun and the wings melted and he fell. That's that. And I don't know if that was the best name for the mission. I don't know if I would board a ship called the Icarus heading to the sun and expect to get back home. But the other thing it reminded me of is the myth of Prometheus. Not the terrible alien movie, but the actual myth. And Prometheus was this, you know, trickster, and he stole fire from the gods and brought it to Earth. And now we have this group of amazing scientists and pilots and captains, you know, on this mini Earth. They can make their own food. They can make their own oxygen. They can pilot this huge nuclear weapon through space and essentially bring fire back to the gods. Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of incredible inverse mm-hmm. of what the initial mythology has. So it's like a sense that we've come full circle with the stories we tell ourselves to make sense of the world around us. Mm-hmm. And now we have to continue the story somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I would not board an Icarus, but at the same time, I appreciated that it was kind of tongue in cheek mm-hmm. and it was kind of a fatalistic, right? We're going to do something that we know is complete. We're going to bomb the sun, man.
Yeah.
Like in any other context, this would be a terrible idea, except now where it's humanity's last hope.
Yeah. So I think in talking about that and mythology and all of that, I think it's also important to talk about something we touched on with Event Horizon, which is religion and the space film, or religion in science fiction. And of course, you have Pinbacker and his whole thing of one man alone with God. But I wanted to talk about some of the stuff I watched and read from the British film critic Mark Kermode. And he's quite a big fan of this film. Mm-hmm. He really posits it as one of Danny Boyle's best films and a pretty impressive oeuvre. And Kermode talks about the scientific consultant on the film, Dr. Brian Cox, not Brian Cox of Autopsy of Jane Doe, unfortunately, but another Dr. Brian Cox. And he works for CERN and then a Center for European Nuclear Research. And they talk about the Higgs boson, which is a missing piece of the current particle theory. And often it's this Higgs boson thing is known as the God particle, mm. the one part of particle theory that we can't explain. And I think Boyle, through this film and the film itself, kind of reads this unknown element, this unknown aspect of science and planning and all of that, as there's an understanding that the spiritual dimension is always potentially at play within the narrative and potentially at play within our lives. And I think it's really interesting that Alex Garland has gone on to have this really deeply entrenched science fiction career. And hopefully after Annihilation, he keeps getting to make films.
Hopefully he still wants to.
Yeah. And Danny Boyle was actually going to join the seminary, and then he saw Clockwork Orange. And then he decided he wanted to make films. But he has this kind of tie to religion, and I think this film is actually a really interesting balance between forward-thinking, forward-driven science and spirituality and God and who we are. And, you know, to go back to someone who I also mentioned in the Event Horizon portion of this episode, Einstein, he said essentially something to the effect of science can measure and predict events, but it cannot provide ethical guidance and nurture the inherent good of humanity. That's where religion factors in. And that's where you have this notion of, should humanity continue to exist if we've depleted all our natural resources?
That's right. And it's not that, you know, we've depleted our resources using them wisely and being very careful. We fucked up, you know, like if the sun dies, it's probably our fault.
Yeah, because they don't really go into that in the film. It's just dying.
Although Although Dustin did say when we were watching it, he's like, you know, the sun is going to die someday. And I don't know.
I remember learning that fact when I was like in kindergarten.
Oh my God.
And I was beside myself. I was apparently like inconsolable. I was like, we're going to die because the sun is going to die. And my mom was like, no, it's going to die in like 6 billion years. And then I think I had also just learned about reincarnation because my babysitter at the time was Indian. And that also really upset me to think that I'd be reincarnated when the sun died.
Oh. It upset you to think that you'd be reincarnated?
Well, I don't want to be around when the sun dies. Well,
what if you're something really cool that doesn't need the sun?
Oh, well, that'd be fine.
But yeah, the lines around science obviously really interest me. And I was doing my research on like the sociology of space, which of course came up with all this stuff about, you know, like habitus and, you know, it just
habitus.
Jürgen Habermas did this whole thing about how people have, I don't fucking remember.
Someone has a name, Jürgen Habermas?
Jürgen Habermas was the most contemporary sociologist that
Jürgen
I covered.
Habermas.
I think my blender is. But I was able to find something called astrosociology, and it totally blew my wheels. I was absolutely not aware of this, but the more I thought about it, the more it kind of makes sense. And like going to school for sociology, it's a social science. It's a soft science. It's something that the harder sciences kind of scoff at. But of course, you can't have one without the other. And there is indeed a discipline looking at how science exploration impacts people socially and most significantly how people on Earth live with the knowledge of what's going on in space. For example, like just the knowledge that satellites exist and what that did for communications, what that did for weather forecasting, commercial flight, air travel.
Cable TV.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, the discipline also studies who gets to go to space. Like that's a very privileged position. It's a very elite position. Is there an age, race, class factor? Who gets the grants for space research? Who gets to go? Who gets to know? When they go into space, you know, nobody really owns that territory. So is that information classified? And if so, by whom? All of these things are factored into the social sciences to the point where I became aware of a simulation called the Mars 500, which was a 17-month simulation to study the physical and psychological effects of long-term space travel. And they found that the fluorescent lighting wasn't bright enough to simulate daylight, and it made it hard for crew members to discern night and day, which made for sleep problems, which made for cognitive problems, and like all these things that the softer sciences can contribute to the harder science of space travel. And the thing with astrosociology is that like it's largely speculative. It's not that different from science fiction. And I actually found a paper by a Simone Carotti that argues that science fiction can actually serve to popularize space in such a way that it makes people aware of astrosociological questions and quandaries, which is, again, where Star Trek fits in. And like now I'm going to be watching it completely differently because of that. So once again, Sunshine takes many of these factors into consideration with their inclusion of the Earth room to settle nerves, like the elaborate video communication, the doctor, the importance of hygiene and mental health. I thought it was really interesting that they were like, you get a fucking haircut.
Yeah.
You'll feel so much better.
You're going to look more like Captain America.
Yeah. Yeah. And can I just say, Chris Evans managed to out-dreamy Cillian Murphy.
Can I? I'm going to share something really personal with our thousands of listeners and my friend Andrea right now. The only really good celebrity sex dream I've ever had involved Chris Evans.
Wow.
This was a few years ago, and henceforth, I've always had a soft spot for him.
Yeah, a soft and wet spot. Now, the most interesting thing that came out of all of this research is a definition of science fiction that came from the social sciences. And I'll read it to you, and it's problematic, and you'll hear why it's problematic right away, because I'm going to read it word for word as it appeared in Aldous and Wingrove 2001. Science fiction is a search for a definition of mankind and his status in the universe, which will stand in our advanced but confused state of knowledge, and is characteristically cast in the Gothic or post-Gothic mode. Now, obviously, in 2001, I don't know why any academic is saying stuff like mankind and his, like, smarten the fuck up, Aldous and Wingrove. But I do think it's an interesting definition in that, like, it pinpoints the philosophical elements that always appear in science fiction, once again nailing what it is I love about Star Trek. And we have a pretty good grasp of humanity's role on Earth, which is to say we're the reigning species, for better or for worse. We're wiping out other species for our own ends, and we're stratified in several ways. But these rules change when it comes to outer space, and both these movies present something of a cautionary tale that takes us into theological territory. So for Event Horizon, it's Weir's scientific zeal that made him forget his soul, and it not only killed his wife, it killed him and a bunch of other people. For Sunshine, Pinbacker was really the opposite side of that coin, and although he was a hard scientist, he had a weird fascination with the sun that comes into play with several members of the Icarus too, to the point that it became religious, where he couldn't bear to fuck with God's plan, even if it meant annihilation on Earth.
And so I still kind of have that callback, you know, as we said, with Weir and Event Horizon, that Pinbacker is kind of a bit like a pinhead figure in this film. And how could you not with Pinbacker? Come on. But I should call out that, of course, Alex Garland and Danny Boyle have said that Pinbacker was actually inspired by a character in Dark Star called Pinback. Mm. So there is a parallel there. And for any film sci-fi nerds out there, of course, you will know that Dan O'Bannon wrote Dark Star. And Dan O'Bannon, of course, was one of the writers on Alien. Mm-hmm. So you have that. And I remember when I first saw Sunshine, and there were so many moments that stuck with me from that film, and I find this film really interesting because the different people you talk to who love this film, there's always a different moment that sticks out for them about it. My partner, for instance, he was so affected by Kaneda's death.
Yeah.
Like, he, when we rewatched this together, and he was visibly affected by it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, has to do with his empathic nature and all of the great things about him. And for me, I just remember Pinbacker saying, you know, it's one man alone with God, with that variation of that line. And it's one man alone with God. And then, you know, humanity becomes stardust. I just thought that was such a powerful notion because I was always fascinated by religion, I think, as I've talked about on this podcast, partially because it seems so omnipresent in so many people's lives, but I never participated in it because both my parents are not religious. Mm-hmm. And I just thought about, you know, growing up and, you know, feeling like everyone else had this communion with something else that was above them. And even though my own beliefs, I didn't really believe in it, I just thought that's, you know, you're communing with something bigger than yourself. And to have that kind of strict, close telephone line to this one thing and be alone with it is such an intimate thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, there is nothing about religion that I understood to be really intimate. Mm-hmm. It felt, you know, certainly as I grew up, to be very forced, to be super problematic in many ways, to be really personal. And so this just felt, it was religious and not religious.
Yeah.
In so many ways, and I still find it fascinating, and it sits with me in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. I remember feeling in the beginning that these scientists had a fascination with the sun that bordered on religious. And it's just like you were saying, that there's a power that's so much bigger and greater. And you saw that with the captain, but you saw it most clearly with Searle, who is the doctor. And the very beginning of the film has him in the observation room, and he's like, how much of the sun can I see, computer, short of like completely fucking me over? And he flirts with that line, and he flirts with that line because he's fascinated by it. And it's a weird fatalistic fascination where the sun is what gives us life, but it also can very easily destroy us. It's so powerful. It's so dangerous. It's so volatile. And I actually kind of hoped that later in the film it might come back around to that. It kind of did in Searle's death, mm-hmm. in that he kind of chose the way he wanted to go, which was, yep. again, in the observation room. And it kind of gave a little bit of extra gravity to Kaneda's death. It's just mm-hmm. like, what do you see? You're experiencing something so colossal right now. Like, sorry to see you go, but what a way.
And especially for people like Kaneda and Searle, they fully go all in the experience of the sun and experience of that, whatever that relationship is. Whereas Pinbacker has kind of lived on the outskirts of this thing for 7 years on his own. Mm-hmm. going through whatever he's gone through. And I think what's interesting about Pinbacker as a character is that this is the first sense within the film of something supernatural, because I don't think you can explain him scientifically. how someone can exist in this empty, desolate ship for 7 years.
Yeah.
And then have enough strength and fortitude while being totally off their rocker to fuck with another ship and understand how to fuck with that ship. And, like, holy shit. Like, I still think the scene in Event Horizon with Justin in the airlock is incredible. But that scene when Kappa's in the suit and Mace and the second in command just tie them. Oh,
fucking
and the
Garrity.
Other guy goes off and
you feel his fear and you
because he's the most fearful.
You sympathize with his cowardice because you could not help not being scared. And then, of course, what happens to him where he just kind of gets bopped a little bit off course just enough so that he drifts through space to smash perpetually. There are a lot of points in this film that are just gutting and bleak and nihilistic, and I love it.
I think what's interesting to me about Pinbacker is that he essentially yearns for the destruction of mankind because he sees this as fate, this is rote, this is what we are doing, the sun is dying, we've lived our accepted length of time in this universe.
Yeah, we had a good run.
Exactly. He sees himself as a kind of prophet. And that got me to thinking about one of humanity's favorite things, which is killing in the name of God. And gosh, we have a big ass long history of that.
Oh, yeah.
But I was thinking in particular, kind of bringing it to a more contemporary time, also because I just finished the Netflix series Wild Wild Country, but of the notion of cults and new religions and some of the mass suicides that happened through there, like the Jonestown Massacre, Waco, things like that, which involved murder and suicide. But there was a study by a website called ThoughtCo, and I can link to this in the show notes, that suicidal cults often have really strong apocalyptic theology. So there is a sense that the world is going to end or their way of life is going to end. So they're just going to beat them to the punch and have the way of life that they choose to have in the way they want it by getting out of it the way they choose to. And that actually resonated really strongly with me when thinking about Pinbacker. And they are in an apocalyptic situation.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I'm the leader and I choose this because I've lived close to it and I understand what this is about.
Right.
So.
And of course, like, I mean, the evil inherent in that is he's trying to decide for everybody else. But in this situation where this crew has the weight of humanity upon them, that's the risk you run.
And I think there's something kind of very Old Testament and a bit patriarchal about God knows best, Father knows best. This is the way it is, so we accept it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there is not only in the notion of self-preservation, but in the sense of just saying, no, I choose a different way. I choose something different. Let's look at different things and ways to live.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, why I found it quite important that the final moments of the film happen back on Earth.
Okay, so now that we're there, my question for you, and like I saw a couple of, it's not a question like the inventor, it's not a plot hole per se, but did you interpret the ending as the mission's success?
Yeah. Okay. Did you not?
I found it ambiguous. It looked like the sun rose, and I wasn't clear on if it was especially bright, because that's kind of a weird subjective thing.
Well, because it looked dim.
It looked dim prior to that.
And they were outside and playing. You're not going to be playing by the Sydney Opera House in a nuclear winter at like 6 in the morning.
Okay.
Right? So then the sun actually rises and begins to shine the brightness that you would almost expect by it. So,
gotcha.
And I think that phrase is actually really important. If it seems especially bright, you know we've succeeded. So it does seem particularly bright.
Gotcha.
And, you know, it's the heartbreaking, but also really empowering because you have these characters who you care about and they sacrificed and they succeeded, but they might never truly know. They didn't truly know.
Right. I liked an ambiguous ending. I would have, this entire film is so harrowing and so nihilistic that I would have liked it to be up to interpretation, but that makes sense.
Yeah. But I think Cillian Murphy and his pretty blue eyes knew what they were doing.
He has excessively blue eyes to the point of suspicious.
Yeah.
I think they might have augmented that a little bit. That's okay. So that's our science fiction horror episode. I'm sure it's not, it's definitely not our first, and I'm sure it won't be our last. But these were two films that really tackled the notion of being in outer space and the ethical slash theological quandaries that emerge, and they approach them in really different ways. And I'm glad we talked about them together like this.
Yeah, and I love them both in very different ways.
Yeah.
I hope you guys felt the same way. I hope you guys enjoyed, if you rewatched them for this episode, watching them together. I know it was a very interesting experience for me watching them kind of within a week of each other, mm-hmm. and sitting with them and, you know, feeling this kind of weight of responsibility of humanity.
You felt it?
I felt it.
It's on you.
God help me if I ever get put on a fucking space mission. I'd just be catatonic the whole time.
Oh, my God. That was another thing with Sunshine, is as high tech and as glossy as that ship was, their suits were so shitty and clunky and agonizing.
Ugh.
Anyway, we could go on and on about that, but life goes on and we have announcements.
Class of 2018 t-shirts, they are here. They are here early.
Surprise!
We usually save these for the summer. We do them for 1 month. It's super limited edition. These are still going to be limited edition, but we constantly hear from people, I missed it, I didn't know about it. So we are running them from now, which is April 2018, until September 2018. And we are really pleased to partner with Twisted Tees on this and super excited to have worked with Stacey Ponder on the artwork. She did a great job. And Stacey Ponder, if you don't know, she has the Final Girl blog, which was, it still is, one of my favorite things on the internet, and has the Friday the 13th Death Count book. And we'll link those in the show notes, because if you don't know her, you should.
You wrote the foreword to that, didn't you?
I did write the foreword to that, and she wrote the foreword to my new book on 90s teen horror, which is coming out this year.
Yeah. So we'll have links to both of those things. We'd really love if you pick up a t-shirt, but there's other ways to support the Faculty of Horror. Feel free to review us on iTunes. I've also enabled the review mechanism on Facebook, so if you want to drop us a review there, we would really appreciate it. And as for next episode, we're going to time travel a little bit into the past for another couple of classics.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about two pretty epic movies, one especially epic in the pop culture psyche, and one kind of a cult classic. So we're going to be talking about Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho and Emmerich Pressburger and Michael Powell's Peeping Tom. So these are often considered the origins of slasher films, among some other films, but these two in particular hold a lot of sway and a lot of weight. So I'm really excited to talk about them.
Yeah, it's going to be a great episode. But for now, we are going to liberate for another month. And until next time,
office hours are closed.